The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and it is so nice to have you along with us this first Sunday in December. As we look back on 2018, one of the most significant developments in the world of philanthropy was the introduction of Philanthropy Cloud by Salesforce.org. And I'll be joined this evening by their Chief Executive Officer, Rob Acker, who explains how these new tools will change how we look at our giving.
When you look at giving, it is a very personal thing, but we also want to be connected up to our common humanity. And the fact that you can start to see, like, what personal impact am I making towards this goal? Mm-hmm. How does it roll up to the Sustainable Development Goals, and how are we making progress as humanity? It will connect us all. It will make us feel like we're all part of something bigger.
And we'll have a Better Than Most Corporate Culture segment featuring Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, a Take 5 lightning round, and a report from our partners at the Chronicle of Philanthropy. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, December 2nd. Giving Tuesday, the annual day devoted to philanthropy, raised roughly $380 million for charities from 4 million people, organizers said. The result represents a 27% increase from last year. Boston's Children's Hospital has announced a $15 million grant from the National Football League to study the potential long-term neurological health consequences of concussions among former NFL players. According to data from the Peer-to-Peer Professional Forum, the organization that tracks walkathon-style events, revenue for the 30 biggest such events is down 6.7% overall since 2016, and participation is down 14%. The New York Attorney General's lawsuit against the Trump Foundation can move forward, a New York State Supreme Court judge has ruled. Dollars raised by nonprofits increased 2.6% in the first 9 months of 2018 compared with the same period last year. The spike was driven by a surge in charitable dollars in the third quarter when giving rose 14% compared with the same 3 months in 2017. Since the Great Recession in 2018, undergraduate majors have been shifting away from the humanities. And of all the disciplines, history has fared the worst. Google.org has issued a $25 million call for ideas that use artificial intelligence to tackle tough social and environmental problems. And GiveWell has come out with its annual list of the best nonprofit organizations to support. And among those included are GiveDirectly, Against Malaria Foundation, and Helen Keller International. And finally, there's an awful lot going on that could impact year-end giving. And here from the Chronicle of Philanthropy to help us sort through it all is Heather Jocelyn. Good evening, Heather.
Good evening, Denver.
Let's start with the new federal tax code. Any insights on what its impact might be as we head towards December 31st?
Well, we'll find out for sure as we get into year's end. But one thing that we are seeing anecdotally is a practice known as bundling, which is when a donor gives a large amount of money, usually enough for them to get a tax deduction, and then does not give money the next year or the year after that, possibly. Sometimes they're giving that money directly to the charities they support. Sometimes they're giving it to a donor-advised fund, which is like a checking account for charity. They get a big tax deduction, and then they spend the money through the next few years to the charities they support as they see fit.
Trying to provide a little context here for a moment, how has overall giving been so far in 2018?
It's been surprisingly a little weak. We've had some very big gifts, notably Jeff Bezos has pledged $2 billion, billion with a B, to fight homelessness and help low-income families and build preschools. And then Phil Knight, of Nike, mm-hmm. which is having a big year, gave $1 billion in Nike stock to probably his own family foundation. But overall giving has actually been a little bit weak. It's been down in the first half of 2018. It was down by 2%, I believe. Mm-hmm. And big gifts of $1 billion and up, according to our figures, were also down by $2.2 billion compared to the first half of 2017. So there's some makeup that has to happen in order to achieve the same levels as last year.
Well, as we head into the giving season, is there any one cause that seems to be at the top of donors' minds?
Yeah, disaster relief is one. We've had some big hurricanes, and we've had, you know, wildfires out west and so forth, and then Indonesia had that big earthquake and tsunami in September. So we've had, you know, Hurricane Florence, Hurricane Michael. In a recent study by Classy, which is an online fundraising company, 48% of the donors they surveyed said that disaster relief is their top priority. So other causes need to be aware of that.
Yeah. Well, finally, Heather, are the experts keeping an eye on anything else that could impact year-end giving?
Yeah, there's something. I mean, the stock market obviously has been a little bit lively, shall we say?
Choppy, yep, that's for sure.
This year. So that will have a big impact, especially on larger gifts. And also, Facebook is becoming a big player, and I'm sure a lot of you have gotten your Facebook friends are raising money for their pet causes on their birthdays, and that's becoming a bigger thing. Facebook raised $300 million from those things, those fundraisers over a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's becoming a bigger deal.
Well, thanks very much, Heather, for this report. It was great to have you on the show.
It's great to talk to you, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to the Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's the Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful, because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
Because of technology, much of what we do and how we do it has changed dramatically over the past decade. Facebook for socialization, Amazon for shopping, Netflix providing entertainment, and Google retrieving that information we want or need. But beyond being able to give online, not so much in the world of philanthropy has changed. But that may be changing with the introduction of Philanthropy Cloud by Salesforce. And here to tell us about it is Rob Acker, the Chief Executive Officer of Salesforce.org. Good evening, Rob, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver. It's an honor to be here.
So tell us a little bit about Salesforce.org and what the mission of the organization is.
Well, the simplest answer is that we were started in 1999 as the foundation. In 2013, we changed to Salesforce.org, and our mission is to improve the state of the world, and we do it in three ways, with technology as well as investment, which you might call grants, and then the third way is also community, which is we get involved and our employees involved in the community and give back time back into the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get into all that, one of the things that I've always admired about Salesforce is your ability to look at the broader context of what's happening in society and only then create initiatives and products that fit into that landscape. So let's touch upon several of those larger issues first, Rob, if we may. And let's begin with trust. You know, the Edelman Trust Meter indicates that trust is really at historic lows. People have just really lost faith in our bedrock institutions. Speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I find it ironic. It's really interesting. I think that this is one of the greatest times in human history to be alive. If you look at many measures or in many measures of how we measure progress, it's extraordinary. Like, for instance, extreme poverty. If you were born in 1820, 94% of the world's population lived in extreme poverty. Today, it's just 8%. which means it was a high degree of likelihood you were going to be born into extreme poverty, no matter what your race was, what country you were born in. And so the thing is, but if you look at basic education, literacy, child mortality, vaccination, we have made remarkable progress. Yet at the same time, like, none of us feel that way. We feel very anxious. And the question is why? And that Edelman Trust in the barometer, trust in media, trust in government, trust in nonprofits, as well as business. United States fell 37 points last year. This is extraordinary dichotomy of things kind of going on that are completely opposed.
Why do you think we feel so stressed, so anxious? I mean, I know your friends and colleagues and mine as well, everybody is on edge. Something is missing. They're worried about something. What's at the heart of that?
So that's a great question. My theory about it is that we live in a connected world. And so there's a number of things that are happening. The same thing that's driving all that progress is that we're connected. And now we're more than ever connected. Everybody's got a mobile phone. Mm-hmm. We can see things and we're informed about things. So like I sometimes use this as an example, but Malala, you know, if you were born in 1820, going back to that date that I just referenced, you would have never heard of Malala.
That's
but
right.
Now we do. And it's in your home and it's in your living room. So that's a positive, but it's also creating anxiety. The fact that we're hyper-informed anytime there's a horrible incident, a school shooting, when something bad happens in the Ukraine, a bus gets bombed in Yemen, Syria, an earthquake, a hurricane, natural disaster, they hit our phones.
Instantaneously.
Right away. And so you see that and you're like left, people are left wondering, what can I do about that? And the other thing, too, is that we've also seen technology, too, because on a somewhat related note, being used in ways that we don't like.
Mm-hmm.
We see it being used to promote hatred, to divide us. And, you know, even to influence elections. We saw what happened in Kenya during the elections, but we also... Sound familiar? We saw what happened in our election. And then I also think that there's a third thing going on. There's a rapid pace of change. Some people call it the fourth industrial revolution. And things are changing fast. And people are anxious because jobs are getting replaced and displaced, etc.
Yeah. And to your last point, there's a lack of civility. 84% of people said that they've experienced incivility. And the average is about 10.6 times a week. And much of that, as you know, is happening online, whether it be the fake news that you just talked about, or people just feeling safe, I think, behind their computer, that they'll just go right after you if you don't share their opinion. It's a serious issue.
It's a big issue. It's actually something that I think about every day. I think about it in the work that I do. I think about it personally. I think about it in raising children. We need to find a way to align around a common set of values and figure out a way where we can respect differences of opinion. And this country was built as a melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
This country was built on diversity. And we talk about diversity and inclusion in the workplace. We talk about it everywhere we go. Yet, for some reason, we're not tolerating diversity of opinions just about everywhere. I do think that there's a role that businesses, technology, et cetera, can play. I'm trying to figure out what that role is. I'm trying to learn as I go about how we can restore trust, how we can restore civility.
Well, tell us what you've learned so far, because you are one of the most optimistic people that I've ever run into. And you really do believe that technology can help bridge the divide. Give us a few thoughts you have on that.
Well, I think being an optimist requires discipline, especially in this time. But I very much am, and here's why. I mentioned the fact that we live in this connected world. We all have mobile phones. We all have these devices, and we're connected. The great majority of people – I work with people on all sides of the spectrum, the political spectrum. We're working with nonprofits, social change agents, and there's people – and what I find is that they might sit on opposite sides of the equation, but they all want to do the right thing and do good. They're not tied to the media narrative where we're being divided. They're trying to figure out ways to connect us and work together across boundaries. So what better way than to use technology, since we're already connected with technology, but to actually allow people to organize, scale, drive, measure, and predict impact with that technology? And the funny thing is contrary to what we might be seeing in the media, when I meet people, these people and leaders on both sides, they genuinely really want to work together. And I think we can take technology and go that last mile and start to connect people up to impact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people want to go from that news feed where they feel anxious to action.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be able to take action, and they also want to be able to find common kindred spirits who are willing to go solve those problems.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it sounds to me what you're trying to do is sort of remove some of the friction that exists. Because getting back to my opening, we were talking about Amazon and Netflix and things of that sort. People can do that instantaneously. And I had Josh Wright on the show the other day. He's the executive director of Ideas 42, and his specializes in behavioral science for social good. And he talked about how we have these great intentions. Let's say you're filling out a financial aid form for your child, but then you run into that piece of information that you just don't have. So you put it aside, and you get back to it 6 weeks later after the deadline has passed. I think a lot of that happens in social good. We see something, we want to do something, but it's not as easy as hitting a one click on Amazon. And that is something which you're doing around this philanthropy cloud. Tell us a little bit about how that will work.
Yeah, so the idea came is, it's actually a fairly long story. I'm going to try and keep it brief. But many years ago when I first came into what was then the Salesforce Foundation, I moved over from Salesforce in 2013. We had 60 employees. But but there was a really interesting phenomenon going on. People wanted businesses to get more engaged. And we were getting hit on every issue from every angle and asked to get involved. And I didn't want to let people down. I wanted to be able to serve and these people. But they're just with 60 people. How am I going to be able to respond? But we were a great bridger and connector between a number of different issues. So going back to then figuring out, like, there's got to be a role for technology. I mean, if I can go on Amazon, who sells 540 million unique, distinct products in the United States, and I can find what I'm looking for, there's got to be a way to
and have
it
on your front door in the next day or two.
Right, exactly. And, if there's 17 sustainable development goals, there's got to be a way to, like, line up around these causes. So if we could put these kind of social issues and go from that news feed, whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's environmental issue, and line people up at an individual level to be able to kind of figure out, go as far as they want to go and impact, whether it's giving money, volunteering time and matching up volunteering opportunities, or going deeper, actually a layer deeper to get involved in substantive policy issues. If you could do that for every individual and then track that back to our global progress against the sustainable development goals, big idea, but it can't be that hard to do.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a customized way. Well, why don't you walk us through the Philanthropy Cloud experience? What do I need to do to set it up? And then what will it provide for me?
So the idea is that, first of all, we are primarily distributing it right now to companies and organizations. There's a big movement. Michael Muller, the Director General of the UN, introduced me to the Sustainable Development Goals. And I thought, well, if we can map back every, you know, social issue that's going on to a Sustainable Development Goal or every cause, you know, companies are being pressured to measure their footprint, not only by the global, you know, body that exists, but also by individuals. Millennials have changed the game.
Yeah. Investors.
Investors, too.
Yeah.
And there's a big movement on that. And so if we can measure a company's progress against the global goals, that's a good starting point. So, and I think so we distribute it back, directly to companies, but there's a big solid individual use case within that. So if I am a company and I want to have a branded cause that my company cares deeply about, ocean cleanup, let's say, for instance, but I'm an individual who might be second generation Syrian, I might care about the Syrian refugee crisis. You might have a branded site for my company or for the company I work for that's ocean cleanup, but I might be interested in saying, like, okay, I live in Buffalo, New York. I'm a second generation Syrian. I'm interested in the Syrian refugee crisis and what's going on there. I can find what I'm looking for. I can map myself back to volunteer opportunities, giving opportunities, or maybe even go more deeply into the substantive issues or the policymaking issues. And it starts to intelligently pick up who I am, where I live. The interesting thing for an individual is that if I leave that company and I go to another company, it will take my individual giving record with me.
Oh, that's cool.
But my footprint will be left behind.
Mm-hmm.
So both win in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So the fastest way to do it that we're doing it right now is we're trying to distribute through corporations first, and then we're going to figure out how to go directly to the individuals.
Mm-hmm. And as you begin to fill out this profile and decide what you're interested in and get these news feeds, you have something called Einstein. Tell us about Einstein.
Well, I inferred this a little bit, but Einstein will pick up, you know, your interest areas, your demographics, you know, based on, let's say, for instance, I use that example, Buffalo, New York. It'll pick up and say, okay, here is what you are interested in. Here's what generally captures your attention. It'll see what you're watching in terms of what you click on, et cetera. And it'll start to intelligently match you to things that might be most relevant to you based on your geography, based on your interest areas. And so that rather than, like I said, if you were shopping on Amazon, 540 million unique distinct products, you can find what you're looking for. Well, That experience should be exactly the same way when you're going after philanthropy. You don't have time to sort through every single cause and issue and then all the organizations around it. So it's trying to intelligently map back the most relevant opportunities to you.
Yeah, sort of one-stop shopping. So yeah. The way it is right now, if I read an article, I care about it, then I have to go and find an organization that is doing something about it and go on to Google and get to that organization. And when you take all those steps and you can have them all together integrated, it makes all the difference in the world. It does remove the friction.
That's right. And the goal is exactly that, to remove the friction. And you know, I think the thing is that if you go online and you're trying to find something and it takes you more than a few minutes, we are all like very short attention span people. So it's got to be a quick, easy, very simple to use experience for the individual, but also to deploy.
Yeah, I remember the old AOL days when you get the 5 hours and you get the whirly thing going around. We spend all our time waiting. Now we wait a nanosecond. Mm-hmm. And we've moved on to something else. Well, you talked about you're distributing this to partners and a key partner of your You talked about that you're distributing this to companies right now.
Yes.
And a key partner of yours from the very outset was the United Way. And we just had the great pleasure of having their CEO, Brian Gallagher, on the show a couple months ago. Why were they the perfect fit for Salesforce, and what has their contribution been to this effort?
So it's a really funny story. So I initially, when we started looking at this idea about – it's almost 2.5 years ago – I had Brian Gallagher and a number of people out in the office from United Way, and I said, what do you think of this idea? And they're like, we need to do that. Mm. And we were talking about working with them as a technology partner just to distribute our software to them. And they're like, well, we should work on this together. And so then Brian and I started working really closely. We talked to Mark Benioff. The other thing, too, is that we are a public benefit corp, but we're a nonprofit. So I can't go raise money to go build such an amazing platform from the outside world. So it dawned on us, like, we're the world's number one CRM vendor. United Way has over 100 years of basically corporate giving experience. Why not take what you do best, United Way? Why not take what we do best, and let's co-invest, and let's make this thing really work?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Rob. You know, there are a lot of people out there who really care and want to help others, but they can have a difficult time finding a cause that they feel really passionate about. Mm-hmm. Can Philanthropy Cloud help in this regard?
Yes. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number. You can search by causes. You can sift through content. You can search by causes. It's very much the best way I would put it is it is very much like going on to Amazon and shopping. And we want to have an engaged experience, one that you can kind of look at different issues and study issues and start to learn about the issues, have rich content that really attracts you so you can browse through it. You don't have to always have the end result be that you're going to give money or find a volunteering opportunity. It's more about how do I study an issue and how do I find interesting content that informs me of these issues, that gets out of this divisive narrative that we have today,
mm-hmm.
that is really trying to take you down a path of understanding the issue in a highly objective way. And what that'll do is that'll start to pull in people, and it'll start to give people hope.
Mm.
Because I think right now the current media narrative makes people feel anxious too, because the media narrative is highly divided because that's what sells.
That's right.
And the thing is that is pulling a lot of people away. That's creating a lot of anxiety, a lot of hopelessness. And that's why that dichotomy that we talked about in the beginning, why I feel optimistic, because the stats are showing that it's amazing. When you go from 94% of the world's population being in extreme poverty to 8%, the challenge is we're not reflecting on that progress we've made. We're hyper-focused on the 8%.
Hmm.
So then, okay, that's a great thing, though, to be hyper-focused on the 8%. But let's not make that a negative thing. Let's ask ourselves, how do we supercharge that and take that capacity of people who want to be engaged, want to understand the issues, make it interesting so that they actually engage and we can go fix that 8%. And they feel hopeful, not hopeless again.
Yeah. And you're not being a Pollyanna here. What it does is it puts things in context, though. I mean, we've lost context. We never look at the course of human history. We're just looking at the moment and what we're being fed. Now, Rob, Philanthropy Cloud integrates into two of your other platforms. One of those is Nonprofit Cloud. And the other is Education Cloud. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so one of the extraordinary things about being the number one CRM vendor, connected to the number one CRM vendor in the world, and the fact that we live in this connected world, is giving us an extraordinary opportunity to actually connect those two up and drive incredible impact. I would argue our greatest area of impact is through technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea behind the Nonprofit Cloud, which we launched this year, is that because everybody's connected, nonprofits can connect with their constituents, their donors, their advocates in ways we never previously imagined, which will drive impact. It will measure impact in ways that we could have never also imagined. And so when you think about that, whether you have 8 people in your organization or 8,000 people in your organization, you can connect up with hundreds of millions of people. Mm-hmm. In the old days, it was direct mail. It was very manual. It was you couldn't scale. You can now scale, regardless of the number of people, in ways that are going to change the world and drive more impact. The same thing is true on a little bit different note is also with education. Imagine from the time you are recruited, let's say in higher ed, recruited as a student, to the time you're a student, and what was your student experience like? And then all the way to where you're an alumni, where you are changing the outcomes of education. I'm managing my education over my mobile phone. Not only can I schedule an appointment with an advisor, I might be able to join an intramural group. I might get content published to me in highly personalized ways. You know, let's say I was a poli-sci major. Somebody's coming in, a former Speaker of the House is coming in onto campus. Let's target them. Let's create a rich experience for them.
Mm-hmm.
What ends up happening is I end up becoming really connected to my institution. But if you're the institution on the other side, you start to have an entire student body, an alumni body connected up to the institution as well. And you can start to measure what's working, what's not working. Why are people dropping off between freshman and sophomore year?
Mm-hmm.
With people in these majors that aren't successful, what majors did they – and there's universities doing that. What majors did they transfer to where they had a better outcome on their career? And what happened to the poli-sci majors? Did they become lawyers? Did they become business people? Did they – what? And these become really interesting statistics that will inform us on what's working, what's not working in education.
Yeah, that's all very interesting. And, sometimes I think about giving, and it so often is a solitary act, as you were talking to about before, direct mail. You're in your home, you just send a check. But it sounds the way you speak here, Rob, is that Philanthropy Cloud has a way of connecting you to making you part of something much larger and then seeing what that much larger is accomplishing. And that just absolutely changes your perspective about yourself and about the world and about the issue you're trying to solve.
You know, it's a really interesting point that you just hit the hammer on the nail, because I think the thing is that when you look at giving, it is a very personal thing. But we also want to be connected up to our common humanity. And the fact that you can start to see, like, what personal impact am I making towards this goal?
Mm-hmm.
How does it roll up to the Sustainable Development Goals? And how are we making progress as humanity? It starts to kind of – it will connect us all. It will make us feel like we're all part of something bigger.
And solving something. I mean, when I get a mail, let's say, to help the famine in sub-Saharan Africa, if I send in $50, what difference does that make? I mean,
right.
There's millions of people. But when I see I'm part of this incredible cohort of millions and collectively we're doing this, I say, we can actually solve this.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And that's why you said earlier, I don't want to sound Pollyanna here, but I really fundamentally do believe this. And I believe it's needed now more than ever,
mm-hmm.
because I do think that we need to restore hope. We need to restore trust, and we need to restore, the focus on what we have in common. Everything that we're talking about today is like, why are we different and how we're different and why our differences are either right or wrong. And like, if we can start to line up around a common enemy, which is whether it's an environmental concern or a common enemy, which is a disaster or lineup, then we can start to stop being common enemies amongst ourselves and then focus on things that are going to help humanity for generations.
Definite game changer. Let's discuss your giving a little bit. And two of the areas that you have particularly invested in are education and mm-hmm. workforce development. Why those two, Rob?
Well, I mentioned it in the beginning, but it starts with, first of all, we started with when 2013, our grants budget was $8 million.
Mm-hmm.
This year it's going to be $50 million. My goal is to get up to $100 million on an annual basis. The thing is that, that may be a lot of money, but you can't solve every problem in the world with that. So it's about focus. And when we realized what area can we influence the most with focus and with those dollars, it was education and workforce development. Because as a tech company, there's a thing that's going on right now. I referenced it earlier, the fourth industrial revolution. And there's a great risk that large groups of people get left behind as industries shift. There's a lot of anxiety about it. I actually think there's more anxiety than will pan out into reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the loom was created, everybody in the textile industry was mortified, thinking that, like, oh, the textile industry is dead. But here we are. several hundred years later, and textile industry is alive and well. It's just industries are shifting, and new jobs, meaningful jobs, are being created. Guess where the biggest shortages are with the most meaningful jobs? In the tech industry.
Yeah.
750,000 jobs in the UK by 2020, shortage. High-paying jobs. Meanwhile, other industries are getting phased out. We have similar stats here in the United States. So let's invest in education because, one, it will ensure that people have hope, that we have a diverse, a talented, and empowered, skilled workforce that's prepared for the skill with the skills they need for the 20th century, 21st century. Sorry, wrong century. I'm old. But the thing is that let's make sure that they're prepared for that. And I think tech companies have a role in also helping universities and other organizations or some of these workforce development organizations readapt their curriculum. Mm-hmm. Amazing organization out here and by the way, in New York that's doing just this, Coalition for Queens.
Yeah, yeah, they're fantastic. You also encourage your employees to give their time back to the community. What does Salesforce do to help support those efforts?
So what we do is, the numbers are astounding. Cumulatively since we started at Salesforce in 1999, it's been about 3.2 million hours. We're about to do a million hours just this year. And
congratulations on that. That's stupendous.
It's amazing. And mm-hmm. you know, I think companies that aren't thinking about this, they're going to need to, because millennials are demanding it. And I think if you want to retain and track talent, you've got to
definitely.
Do it. Mm-hmm. And so the things that we encourage employees to give in whatever ways they want. It could be with their church, volunteering in their schools, et cetera. One of the more focused areas that we have spent time on is we've encouraged all of our executives to circle a school in their local community.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you often hear about the grant dollars that we give out in San Francisco and Oakland and other areas that have big employee bases. But I would say probably the most impactful thing that we do is we circle these schools, and we've seen employees help everything from the teachers who know how to teach. They know how to do their job, but they need help in kind of building a computer science curriculum, and they tell us where they need help and we'll help.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they want us to paint a school, we'll do that. The biggest thing, and this is probably the biggest highlight and learning lesson for me, was that you can't be what you can't see. And when you go into neighborhoods that are underserved, and we sit in these big towers in Silicon Valley, some of these kids, their parents and the people in the neighborhood are not working in tech. So they don't understand who we are and what they do. So there's a division almost from the day they're born. You start bringing these kids and connecting with them, they start to realize, hey, these are real people. I could see myself doing this job.
Yeah.
And these one conversations, these robotics programs have just exploded. Sometimes one conversation really can change a life. Several conversations can change several lives. Highly inspiring to the employees and really, really cool. And this is the type of thing that bridges communities together.
Yeah, sort of a lot like Genesis, who you support, getting those kids
very
working
so.
In corporations. And they can say, you know, I thought they were way up here, but I could be one of those.
That's absolutely right. And it's been really neat. We've actually hired interns, and then some people full-time from both Europe Genesis
Works. Yeah, both have been on the show. We've enjoyed them both.
Yes.
Do you give them paid days off to do this?
7 paid days off. It's important. I think it's really important. Companies really need to – and this is something that I want to be careful that I'm not lecturing other companies. Everybody has their own giving model.
Yeah.
They're all unique, and they all have – they're doing extraordinary things. But what we realized is that if you really – people are really busy right now. They have families. They've got jobs. But if they are really going to be passionate about their work, there's always something missing. And so the only way to really give them the opportunity to give back is give them 7 paid days off.
Mm.
Otherwise, they just can't take the time. They can't justify it. And the other thing that we do is with that is we will measure it. So when you go to these big company kickoffs, we might be celebrating, you know, here's the top salesperson, here's the top person at Salesforce I'm talking about. And you usually do your awards based on that. But then we'll have the top volunteers at every
–
and almost – really, not almost, talked about just like we talk about the top performing salespeople. And the stories are so inspiring. There was one woman in Atlanta. I can't remember her name. But she was closing out her fourth quarter, but volunteered at a local hospital. And the night as she was closing out her fourth quarter, as a salesperson, which usually is like everything comes down to the wire.
Yes.
She ended up doing an all-nighter in the ER in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And moved people to tears at our company kickoff. Just that kind of dedication and passion. It inspires people.
Yeah, and a good set of priorities. And I know from the time I spent out in your offices, it's really baked in. I mean, they're going out in the community doing volunteer work during their orientation period and their onboarding.
Yes.
You know, Salesforce and Salesforce.org, because of the nature of the work you do and the clients you serve, you're in a very interesting intersection where you can view the social good initiatives of the nonprofit, the business, and the governmental sectors. Are we seeing greater collaboration among them to solve real problems, or are they still pretty much pursuing separate tracks?
Absolutely greater collaboration. Even in the nonprofit sector, when I first started, it used to frustrate me. I thought, you know, locally in San Francisco, Oakland, I would see people, we'd be working on the same issues, not talking in our own swim lanes. Now it's one giant swim lane.
Mm-hmm.
But even more at a global level, I think that there's been more of a push as things have become more dysfunctional, say, let's say here in Washington. I think that there's been a push for business to get more involved, to help kind of break the stalemate and take a bigger role, both from employees and also from the outside. So I've seen incredible global collaboration. We work, for instance, and it's been a thrill to be a part of working with some of these organizations like Southern New Hampshire University. They're democratizing education. They're providing this online education. They want to train and help refugees. I meet with Filippo Grandi. He's the High Commissioner for Refugees for the UN. Now, Filippo Grandi is trying to figure out how to get education to the refugees. He knows everything about the infrastructure of the camps, how to get all of this stuff done, but he's not an education expert. Paul LeBlanc is. They're starting to work together. We kind of broker this introduction because they're both partners of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And so, here you have us representing the business community. You've got a university and you've got a government agency. I guess you could call the UN a government agency. And this movement's actually getting bigger. And so I'm very optimistic that we're going to start breaking through our silos and operating in one giant swim lane as opposed to like our little silos.
Mm-hmm. That's good to hear. Back in September, you held 4 days of inspiration and giving back out in the Bay Area. It was called Dreamforce 18. Tell us about it. Tell us what goes on there.
Well, so Dreamforce is the largest technology conference in the world, and it is a mix. What's beautiful about Marc Benioff, and this is why I've stated
that is your CEO.
He is
of
the
Salesforce.
CEO of Salesforce.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is amazing about Marc Benioff is he exposes people not only to the world's leading technology, but also thought leaders and as well as nonprofits and businesses. And it's literally like a connection point. And I think until you actually go to it, I've talked to a number of CEOs who were just blown away by the opportunities that are presented there. You have well over 100,000 people there, all connected and looking at the possibilities of technology, but also the possibilities of collaboration and giving back to your kind of multi-sector question. These things all converge and you have thought leaders there. You'll have ex-world leaders there. You'll have nonprofit leaders there speaking. You'll have business leaders speaking. You'll have thought leaders, futurists speaking. And I think it's really an incredible conference to talk about what is, I would say it's as much a technology conference as it is like almost a mini Davos as well.
Yeah, sure.
More of a grassroots Davos where people are trying to align around common messages, figure out how we work together and how we can use technology to work together. It's amazing.
Dreamforce 19 is already in the works. It's going to be in November next year.
November.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this, Rob. If you look ahead, let's say 5 years, in addition to what the philanthropy cloud can do with respect to effectiveness and efficiency and ease for the individual and for the company, how do you believe it will impact the sector at large, the total amount of money raised, the way we go about solving our problems, and things of that nature?
That's a big – I would hate to put a number on it, but here's what I would like to see.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see over a billion people on this, at least within the next 5 years. And that way but I would hate to put a number in terms of how much we would raise and by each specific SDG, but billion users, that's what I want in the next 5 years. But I also want it to help change the psychology of the world today from one of anxiety to one that actually can get engaged constructively and feel like they're constructively engaged and not watching all of this kind of chaos and angst that's going on right now. They feel like there's a platform and something that takes them into constructive engagement. There's more needed than just the philanthropy cloud to do this, but I hope that it does its part in helping make the world a better place.
Well, that is aspirational and audacious, and we need it just about now. Well, Rob Acker, the Chief Executive Officer of Salesforce.org, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Where can people learn more about Philanthropy Cloud, Education Cloud, Nonprofit Cloud, and all the other things that you do?
www.salesforce.org.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Rob. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org.
I used to have more hair. I used to have more color. And I used to have cancer. I beat it. I did. Not alone. I used to have no idea what the American Cancer Society did. Research? Yeah. But also free rides to chemo and free lodging near hospitals. I used to maybe give a little. Then I got so much back. I used to have cancer.
Please give at cancer.org.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting Benetech.org.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And for this edition, we took a trip up to Massachusetts and to the campus of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We'll begin with their president and director, Mark Abbott, and then you will hear from some of the other members of the team.
Being out on a research ship, you have to work together. You get physicists, chemists, biologists, and that's just inherent in the DNA of ocean science. But at Woods Hole Oceanographic, since we're all focused on that, we're not doing undergraduate teaching, we're not part of a large university that has other activities, be it engineering or liberal arts, all good things, but we're really focused on understanding the ocean as a system that really empowers a lot more team building. And because to attack the science, you've got to all work together.
I think that those kinds of activities happen a lot at the institution, where we have the opportunity to go out and do a very unique scientific expedition to address a unique scientific problem, often something happening in the environment that the public is very aware of. And I think that's something very unique here, because we have such a large scientific staff, that we have the integration of engineering and science and support from policy to education to communications, that all of that can really come together and help us mobilize and quickly get out and do really novel science.
The thing that makes it possible to cross these boundaries at HUI are simply the fact that it's a very open and collaborative culture. If you walk down any of the hallways here, the doors are always open. You feel very welcome in the other departments. Again, I feel like I can walk across the street, poke my head into anyone's lab, and there will be someone there who is excited to talk to me about whatever they're working on. And I don't know if it's the fact that architecturally HUI has been built so that it's easy to go into everybody's lab, but you walk down the halls in Bigelow, right, and people are standing in the stairways having conversations, or you can easily pop in and talk to anybody.
I think one of the reasons it's so easy to collaborate at HUI is because there's so few rules at HUI. I came here after working 10 years other places and was sort of shocked to find out that no one was going to tell me what to do. I came in not as a senior person with some responsibility, and there was nobody telling me how to run my projects, nobody who I was particularly reporting to other than did it get done and did I please the sponsor. And so if I want to talk to somebody in another department and seek more work, there's nobody telling me not to find that interesting work. There's nobody, in fact, the people will encourage me. You get credit for doing that.
And the first thing they all said was, it's incredibly welcoming. People are kind and nice, and they take you in right away and ask you questions and make you feel like you're going to be taken care of. And in fact, in our lab, we had a sign over our computers that said, that read, take care of your job, take care of yourself, take care of each other.
We don't put out something that we feel isn't vetted. I mean, the scientists, they go through a vetting process with their peers, you know, out at conferences, you know, where they're in this sort of culture of, you know, you put something out there and you have to be prepared to have someone else question it. And then as a communicator, I mean, we are vetting. We do not put anything out that hasn't been vetted. Sometimes 10, 15 times. You should see the version numbers on some of the communications that we're putting out. So I think, you know, there's a lot of wow to that, you know, that sort of like we are here to explore this place, try to better understand it, and to communicate it so we can better be better stewards.
But every single day I can come into my own lab and prioritize how I'm going to use my time. And if I have a new idea, I can make time to test that idea out in my lab. And it is incredibly, that sense of freedom is liberating. You know, you can come up with new ideas every single day, work with your team, and try to discover something new. And I don't think you'd have that at a different type of institution where someone is overseeing every little thing that you're doing and micromanaging your time. And I really value that here.
It is this long-term research institution. So it allows you to really sort of tackle some of the big questions that you want to get to. And so that kind of gets the basically back to that other word, the flexibility. So you have a real flexibility to kind of choose what you want to do, what question you think is really important, and how to best basically tackle that. So how do you really get the job done? And you get a lot of flexibility in that. And that gives you access to doing stuff that's really rapid, gives you access to the sort of the family support that you need here as well, too, so you have a lot of flexibility.
To go to the quaint little restaurants, including the Captain Kidd and the coffee shop, and also to take the ferry over to Martha's Vineyard. So it's very much a place that people want to come and see, that tourists really value, and we're lucky to be able to work in a place that everybody wants to come to. And I think that free parking perk is fantastic on weekends and evenings in particular, when you also want to share the environment and try to get into some of these busy, bustling restaurants that we are able to park right there for free, whereas many people have to park several miles down the road and take buses into our town.
The other thing that I like about that working on cool stuff with great people, I can work with academics and scientists on a broad range of different problems outside of my own discipline. And I can also find engineers to help me bring ideas to life. You know, you're not doing this work in a vacuum at HUI. There's a whole group of electrical, mechanical, and software engineers who you can hire onto your projects to help you implement things. And you can have admin support to help manage large projects and to go after grants.
Poor behavior should be followed by no one will work with you, and you don't, if you're on soft money, you don't have money to spend. You don't have a job. Aaron won't hire you if you're a jerk. And that's really part and parcel of working at HUI, is that if you're a bad actor, you get a reputation, and you usually don't last that long. It's not entirely true. There are exceptions, but to a large extent, the feedback you get is kind of direct and kind of monetary, and you don't get interesting work. You don't get to work with good people. And for many of us, that working with the good people and having interesting work is a primary reason for coming to HUI. So behave well. Those people will want to work with you. You can work on great things together. And it's not so much a disciplinary thing, it's a very positive thing. You form good teams that way.
We have a robust workplace climate committee and a women's committee. And quarterly, they have workshops that they call community teas. And it's a place where people come together in one of our buildings. And the last one, we had 100 people there at least. And they select a topic. So one was implicit bias, and the last one was gender equity in various tasks, whether it's in the field, the lab, or the office. And you have a paper that you read ahead of time, and then they have questions that they offer to direct the conversation. But typically, they just have a very brief introduction, and then they ask people to get into tables. So there's maybe 5 to 6 people at the table, and then they just openly talk, and they might use a question as a prompt.
In some cases, you can actually build an instrument to do things for you that are a lot more efficient than going out and grabbing a sample on your own. So the one skill that I've learned is that if you can think of it, you can probably convince someone here to build it for you, and you're going to get way more data with better precision, better accuracy, and in general, you're going to do better science.
When it's little, the job I kind of wanted was a job that I didn't have to feel like I was going to work every day. And we've kind of talked about this a little bit, but this is basically the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is a community of people that love the ocean. We just love the water. And so that's either going swimming quite often or studying the water or bringing your dog down to the water, whatever sort of that interactions. We really sort of we like that sort of water and aquatic atmosphere. And this sort of hub down here really sort of provides that. And then that community really kind of fosters that interdisciplinary collaboration. It kind of breaks down the silos almost inherently in that we have this group of people that sort of really have a passion about the same kind of thing.
I wanted to mention another unique workplace feature here at HUI, and that is that a lot of us spend time at sea, extended periods of time, either in the field, at a coastal field station, or actually on a research vessel. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these are a couple of weeks, sometimes these are many weeks, or even a couple of months. And there are some very unique aspects of being at sea together with a group of people. There's a lot of camaraderie that develops, a lot of working together, a lot of mentoring of each other that you really can't experience day to day out at the workplace. My students call going to sea a summer camp for scientists because you're really just, you're with each other 24/7 and you're forced to be together.
I would like to address the question of innovation. HUI is unique in that it doesn't just foster innovation, it fosters innovation in the real world. It's not innovation for innovation's sake, but innovation for the sake of addressing very difficult environments that we encounter every day as scientists. So you have to have things that work in the open ocean, that work in the Arctic, that work in very hot and humid climates. And so the engineers here aren't solving toy problems. They're solving real problems that existing technology doesn't work for.
There's just you and the maybe 12 other people that are involved. You're going to be out there for a set number of days. It's either going to work or not work, and it's going to be a bad couple of weeks if it doesn't work. But when I think of the things I'm proudest of and happiest of at my work at HUI, they all involve making things work at sea with a bunch of people who I like being there with.
Another very exciting thing about innovation at HUI is we offer a pitch-a-thon. And last month, the technology office offered this. 4 scientists and engineers had to pitch an idea, whether it's technology or data management or a battery that can last longer, withstand salt water and be underwater. They had 10 minutes to give a pitch, and the whole town was invited, which was very exciting. And I think that's very new for us. Typically, we pitch something maybe with someone down the hall or pitch something with your department. But this pitching to the whole community was very exciting. And the reward is $75,000 as startup money to then move forward with whatever your technology is or your data management is or your battery pack is.
That's basically pride in kind of trying to be the best institution in the world. It comes from all across the institution to have that. So I think
And we get that in a way through, or at least I feel like I get that support through a lot of mentorship and support. So I can, like I said, easily go down the hall and ask folks. And but there's, if I have a question, and we try and keep that sort of open door policy, and there's just an abundance of safety nets to kind of keep track of you and make sure you're getting, you know, the mentorship or the ability to ask questions if you need to.
People want to see impact in more ways than just how many scientific papers did you publish where you were the first author. So we want to start to look at what is the importance of their impact beyond just the science. That's obviously the gold standard. But did you engage with students? Did you engage with public agencies? Did you really unlock and enable other scientists to succeed? And again, it's kind of building on that culture.
I would like to thank Colin Reed for helping to arrange my visit and to all those who participated in this piece. Amy April, Aaron Fischel, Jonathan Howland, Stephanie Mattson, Danielle Fino, Colin Ward, and Aaron Mooney. If you'd like to hear this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of the participants, come to denver-frederick.com, where we'll have a link to my full interview with Mark Abbott, the president of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
It's time for Take Five, a recurring feature of the Business of Giving, with five or so quick questions posed to the leaders of the world of philanthropy, business, and social enterprise.
So we're going to play Take Five with Sean Mayberry, the Executive Director of Strong Minds. Are you ready, Sean?
I am.
What is one of your favorite documentaries or movies?
I get so much grief from my family. I love the movie Moulin Rouge.
What is today's most underreported story?
I think the crisis in Myanmar continues to be underreported.
What should we be worried about?
We should be worried about our children using too much technology, and how do we get them to step away from that and read books and have relationships and friendships?
What is something you believe that other people think is just insane?
I believe that the depression epidemic in Africa can be solved using a simple approach.
Name some organization or person that you have a tremendous amount of respect and admiration for.
You know, I love Vision Spring, who's headquartered here in New York City, which provides affordable eye care to the poor. It's a huge need. I used to work there, and I love their work.
What is your most favorite part of your morning ritual?
My favorite part is being able to say just hi and good morning to all the children as they come down the stairs.
What have you changed your mind about in the last 10 years and why?
I actually became a Mets fan. Before that, I was an Atlanta Braves fan, so no regrets.
If you were a kitchen utensil, what would you be?
I'd be a ladle.
What do you wish people would be more open and honest about?
Their mental illnesses of themselves or their family and or friends.
If you were to start your career all over again and do something completely different and away from this field, what would that be?
I'd be writing historical fiction novels.
What's your superpower?
My superpower is just an amazing ability to connect with people.
If you could have one gigantic billboard anywhere with anything on it, what would you have it say?
I would say that depression is a treatable illness that can be solved, and that there are simple solutions that people can be using just to create that awareness.
Name a book you would give as a gift.
Oh, gosh. What book would I give as a gift? I'd give I love reading Alan First's historical espionage novels. He's got a million of them. Probably the current one that I would give out would be The Spies of Warsaw. It's so much fun to read.
What do you think about when you're driving in the car alone?
Oh, lots of things. I think about, am I being a good dad? Am I being a good husband? Am I being a good leader of my organization?
What topic would you speak about if you were asked to give a TED Talk on something outside your main area of expertise?
I would talk about, I would say, you know, what I think have been my secrets to being what I hope to be is a great father.
What is something about you that very few other people know?
Oh, my gosh. There's probably a number of things. Probably a lot of them don't know. That I've lived through five coup d'etats in Africa and Asia.
Given the choice of anyone famous in the world, dead or alive, that you could invite over as a dinner guest, who would that be?
Oh, I know this. I would invite Jimmy Carter over for dinner and Rosalyn.
What's the name of a restaurant that you would recommend?
Oh, there's a great French restaurant in Maplewood, New Jersey called Verjus.
What is the best constructive criticism you've ever received?
probably from my bosses at Intel, just explaining, you know, what you're doing, say, wrong, but helping you to see the positive there. So very constructive.
What's the last thing you taught yourself to do?
How to speak French.
What is something that you dislike that everyone else just seems to love?
I dislike chit-chat. I really like deep conversations where you can learn something and come away with your opinions challenged.
What advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
You know, I love where I am. I think it would be stay the course and be confident and positive, and you're going to make a difference in the world.
And finally, do you have a quote you live your life by or think of often?
Yeah, everyone uses this quote, but really it's the quote along the lines of to whom much is given, much is expected.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Thanks, Denver.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Judy Vredenburg, the president and CEO of Girls, Inc., who has been inspiring girls to be strong, smart, and bold since 1864. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.